Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't think there's anything sinister in trying to get wealthy people and countries that are seriously involved in development to spend their money wisely in a way that helps poor people and lifts them up. I don't think there's anything bad with that. I think it's good.
Bill Clinton speaking to an NBC reporter last year about controversy over the Clinton Foundation. The Clintons have been criticized for allowing wealthy donors in foreign countries to contribute to the foundation while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Donald Trump has suggested that the Clintons traded money for access. Now, Bill Clinton has announced that he will step down from the foundation board if Hillary is elected president, and the foundation would stop taking foreign and corporate donations. For more on the foundation, we're joined now by Peter Nicholas. He covers national politics for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Madeline.
Well, talk about this decision. This came this week that Bill Clinton would step down from the board if they stopped taking foreign and corporate donations. How did this decision come to pass?
Well, this has been a long time coming. The Clinton Foundation has been a lingering controversy that has bedeviled Hillary Clinton's campaign now for over a year. And there are questions about whether there are conflicts of interest here, whether it's appropriate for foreign governments and wealthy foreign donors to be contributing to the Clinton Foundation, given that Mrs. Clinton was running for president, Mrs. Clinton served in the State Department. What's the proper role for her husband, Bill Clinton? Should he be out soliciting donations from these sources? And as your intro said, the Clinton's answer to this is the Clinton Foundation does terrific work. It's fighting disease. It's trying to lower the cost of AIDS medications. It's trying to reduce poverty rates in third world countries. So it's all justified. But in a political context, it's proved untenable for Hillary Clinton. It's just an ongoing source of stories and attention, the likes of which she just doesn't need, given polls show that many people view her as not particularly trustworthy.
So what are the more suspect donations? What are some of the more suspect items that lead people to think that there is something fishy going on between the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation and her role in government?
Well, for example, the Clinton Foundation received donations from a Canadian agency that was promoting the Keystone XL pipeline project. And that was a project that was very controversial. Environmentalists were urging the Obama administration to reject a permit for Keystone, and yet this Canadian agency gave money to the Clinton Foundation. So that's an example of the kind of perception problem that the Clinton Foundation has caused Hillary and Bill Clinton. Also, there have been donations to the Clinton Foundation of millions of dollars coming from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which has a human rights record and a record of treatment of women that some people say is unsavory and suggests that they should not be given to the foundation. So these have all come back and haunted Hillary Clinton's campaign. She's had to answer to this. And they've just decided, the campaign, I think, has decided, Hillary and Bill Clinton have decided that it's not worth it. And they had to do something to change the story narrative and try to allay some of these concerns and deal with this perception problem.
But yet they'll still keep it open until the election, and Bill Clinton will still be there until the election. Is there a problem there in terms of perception?
Well, yes. Some of this won't take place unless and until Hillary Clinton wins the White House. And even after she's in the White House, it's not clear they intend to entirely shut down the Clinton Foundation. We know that CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative, which is the signature program Bill Clinton has been involved in, will be shutting down. But there are other tentacles, other aspects of the Clinton Foundation that could stay open after if Hillary Clinton were to be elected president. So while we're looking at a scaled-down Clinton Foundation if she's in the White House, it's not clear that it's going to be done away with entirely. And if not, it's likely still to be a magnet for controversy.
I wonder if you could untangle this. As you mentioned, there are many tentacles. The Clinton Global Initiative is one of them, and it'll shut down after its last meeting in September. How is that different from the foundation, and what are some of the other tentacles?
Well, the Clinton Global Initiative is a project of the foundation. It's gotten a lot of attention because it has annual meetings where many celebrities attend, and it attracts a number of donations. But there are other aspects of the Clinton Foundation, other work that it does. There's a Clinton Health Initiative that deals specifically with healthcare issues. It's possible that could be spun off entirely and separated from the Clinton Foundation. There's just different sort of pieces of this, some of which are difficult to wind down because the Clintons have collected a $250 million endowment to keep it up and running. There was a vigorous fundraising effort before Hillary Clinton got into the race. And so they now have a huge endowment. And the question is, well, what happens next? What do you do with this? Do you just turn off the lights?
And thousands of people work for it now.
Yeah, well, it does have a large payroll. It has interests. It has projects that it does in Haiti. It has projects in Africa. And, you know, Bill and Hillary Clinton will say these projects are worthwhile or are improving people's lives. So do you necessarily want to pull the plug on it entirely? However, we're entering unique territory here where Hillary Clinton could be the president. Her husband would have a role in her administration. And, you know, there's an understanding, I think, among ethics experts that they're going to have to cure this problem by separating themselves entirely from this foundation.
So is it a question of rebranding? Would you just rename it? Bill Clinton would step aside. Maybe Chelsea Clinton would still remain, but not in a role that would garner much attention?
What we reported today is that it could be turned over to independent operators, independent directors who would have an arm's length relationship to the Clinton family. That's one possibility. Chelsea's role is just unclear. We just don't know if she would continue to play a role in it. And if she does, it's easy to imagine that could cause problems, create questions too, because she's close to her parents, and we expect that if Mrs. Clinton is elected president, Chelsea will play a role in this administration, some role in this administration. We'll be seeing and hearing from her. So I think for her to stay involved in it could potentially be a problem, too.
Let's talk about the money aspect of this. Bill and Hillary Clinton have been paid more than $150 million for speaking engagements over the last 15 years. Did they funnel that money back into the foundation?
There are some cases where Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton gave paid speeches, and they said that they did indeed send that money back to the foundation. In some cases where they spoke to colleges and universities, they said, their defense of that is that they're plowing the money from one nonprofit organization, the school, into the Clinton Foundation. They're not pocketing it. But some of the fees that the Clintons did receive, they pocketed. You know, that was their income. And Bill Clinton has talked about that and said, look, I've got to pay our bills. And therefore, you know, that's why he gave paid speeches. Another open question we haven't discussed yet, but is, will Bill Clinton continue to give paid speeches once if his wife is in the White House? And that's not clear.
It's never been proven, though, that there was any intentional quid pro quo, pay-to-play type of situation, has there?
No, there really hasn't been evidence of that. There's been various perception problems that have been raised, questions about whether donations from the Clinton Foundation coincide with official action taken by the State Department when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So it's a situation which has created appearance problems, and in politics, that's really enough to do damage to a candidacy. And I think Hillary Clinton has paid a price for this with her honest, straightforward numbers pretty low, and various polls showing that the Clinton Foundation, you know, remains something of a concern.
Peter Nicholas covers national politics for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And we'd like to hear from you. Will the Clinton Foundation's connections influence how you vote in November and how you think of Hillary Clinton? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, speaking of tangled webs, on the Republican side, the revelations keep coming about Donald Trump's departing campaign chairman Paul Manafort and his foreign business ties. Emails came out this week directly linking Manafort to a political campaign to boost the image of the Ukrainian government in the U.S. a few years ago. Manafort previously denied ever lobbying for Ukraine's pro-Russian government. The lobbying was apparently supposed to help the Ukrainians get positive coverage in papers like the New York Times. Well, this comes after weeks of news reports on Manafort's long and secretive history working for former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Manafort resigned from Trump's campaign today. Jeff Horwitz is here to explain this. Hi.
Hello there.
Now, you work for the Associated Press. You had an investigation out this week. And can you talk about what you uncovered?
Sure. So Let's sort of do a timeline of the week. The beginning of the week for Paul Manafort, and this has not been a good one, began with the New York Times finding that there was a secret ledger of cash payments that had supposedly been paid to Manafort, totaling $12.7 million. Now, that was a little bit surprising and discomforting, I think, for a lot of people. And Manafort issued a statement stating that the work he had done, not only had he not received that money, but the work he had done in Ukraine was purely domestic Ukrainian politics, that he had never represented the Ukrainian or Russian governments, and that any insinuation to the contrary just flatly wasn't true. Over the next couple of days, work that the AP was doing found that to be flatly contradicted, first by anonymous sources within lobbying firms that were being directed by Manafort's political operation, and then by emails from Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, who is also a senior advisor to the Trump campaign.
Okay, so it appears that he did receive some kind of payments, $12.7 million?
Yes. Well, whether he received that money or not, Ukrainian prosecutors say they are not totally clear. Manafort has said he didn't, but then again, Manafort has also said that he wasn't running a lobbying campaign in the U.S. on behalf of Ukrainian political officials. And the emails we have show that his deputy was not only, as you said, trying to basically influence coverage of major U.S. newspapers, but was also setting up meetings for Ukrainian government officials, was discussing lobbying strategy, was basically doing literally everything hands-on about this. So in terms of what Manafort's saying on that front, perhaps a grain of suspicion might be worthwhile.
Well, yeah. What does Paul Manafort say he was doing then? Because we know that he's had a very long relationship with Viktor Yanukovych.
Paul Manafort was working for Ukraine's Party of Regions for many years. That's the party of exiled President Viktor Yanukovych, who was ousted amid allegations of both brutality against protesters of his regime and also his excessively close ties to Russia, according to those protesters. So he was doing that. That was known. Over the course of this week, of course, there's also been some other bad news. There, Politico reported that there was an effort to collect on debts still owed to him by one of his deputies in Kiev. And Fusion reported that Manafort may have been involved in organizing protests against the U.S. military NATO military exercise in Ukraine, in which crowds showed up to throw bottles and rocks at U.S. soldiers. I'm not making this up.
Wow. What's the evidence that he might have been behind that?
The Party of Regions, which he was advising at the time, certainly was suspected by the U.S. of drumming up sort of furor over this. And there was some insinuation by some of Fusion sources that there might have been more to that. But the one other thing I want to mention related to the $12.7 million in payments that, you know, sort of kicked off this week is that new information released today by Ukrainian prosecutors, reported by some of my colleagues in Kiev, does seem to suggest there may be a connection between that money and the covert attempt to influence U.S. politics and public opinion, because some of the money was going to people who were it was being paid to Manafort via Ukrainian political figures that were involved in setting up the supposed non-profit on the behalf of which Manafort was lobbying and Manafort's team was lobbying and on sort of basically the entity that was providing the cover for him.
So to influence opinion here when the separatist movement was happening in Crimea?
So this would have started in 2012 and run through actually after Yanukovych's departure. So it would have run through August of 2014. And I mean, this is you know, and kind of an unfortunately frequent thing, according to entities like the Project and Government Oversight, that nonprofits basically are used essentially as front groups for foreign political governments to lobby in the United States. It's just that normally one doesn't end up with emails explicitly demonstrating such.
Is that illegal?
Yes, this is the Foreign Agent Registration Act, passed in 1938, which, I mean, the reason it was passed in 1938, not a coincidence. It was to try to detect German efforts to influence the U.S. through propaganda in World War II. And that requires extensive disclosure of basically non-diplomatic, I suppose, efforts to influence the U.S. government or public opinion. And violations of it are punishable by up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. I should note that it is rare to see that enforced, just because there are a lot of loopholes that can get you around it. But the thing is here is that this was a fairly, I mean, with the emails, it really sort of removed a lot of doubts in terms of what exactly was happening. Obviously, I'm sure there will be defenses offered for it, so I shouldn't, you know, jump to any conclusions there.
Now, Manafort apparently got involved with Ukraine and met Yanukovych through an oligarch named Renat Akhmetov, who was later accused of murder. He's the richest man in Ukraine. Can you tell us briefly about their relationship?
There is, in terms of Ukrainian oligarchs, I'm not totally sure that is wildly an unusual track record to have, but at least in terms of accusations. He spent basically a decade pretty much working for Ukrainian political interests. And indeed, a lot of it was sort of diplomatic. Domestic campaign work. I mean, he was sort of credited with, revitalizing Viktor Yanukovych, the ousted president's career. From everything from getting him to actually look like a stylish human being, as opposed to sort of a washed up post-Soviet, kleptocrat. Mm-hmm. And then also getting him to actually talk with people and sort of get into the emotive style of, you know, politics that has been popularized in the U.S.
All right. So all of this leads to today, and Manafort has resigned / been fired from the Trump campaign. Is this all because of this Ukrainian story?
Which portions of it? Yes, I think the Ukrainian stuff is absolutely what is being cited as reasons for his departure. I think, you know, Manafort, according to sort of, you know, what he's saying to other people, not to us, but to other people, is that, you know, he was worried about this being a distraction. But which portion of the Ukrainian news is responsible, you know, for directly, if it's any single one of them, is kind of hard to say. There's just been so much news about Manafort's activities that we could perhaps call unflattering.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Jeff Horowitz. He's a financial and enterprise reporter for the Associated Press. Coming up on the program, unaccompanied minors from Central America are going to school now in L.A., but they bring with them terrible stories from their journeys. How one group is trying to help them with an innovative therapeutic approach. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Public schools started this week in Los Angeles, and entering those crowded hallways and classrooms are many children who came to the U.S. alone after fleeing violence in countries like Honduras and Guatemala. Now, many of them are coping with anxiety, depression, and severe trauma. But therapists in the Pico Union area have developed a new program to help them. Alejandro Lucas is here now. He oversees the program at the nonprofit group. It's called Amanecer. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
T- tell us about what these children are going through. Your organization has seen several dozen of them. What are some of the symptoms that they exhibit?
Many of these students that come through, they've suffered severe trauma, but one in their homeland, so much so that their parents are seeing that there's no way out for them other than to send them to the United States. And they send them by themselves. And as they're crossing through Mexico, a lot of them are re-traumatized. The local gangs take advantage of them. Some of them, to be able to cross the border, they're traumatized by the coyotes or the people bringing them over. In a lot of cases, it's actually a relief to be caught at the border, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
So when they get to Los Angeles, many of them feel very disenfranchised. They're placed with host families, and many times these are family members they don't even know.
And could they also be in foster care with people they've never met?
They can also be in foster care if there's no quote-unquote family that is there to take them in.
And what ages are we talking about typically for your therapy programs?
Well, we get them as young as 5, but we have, I would say, 8 to 18 is primarily the ages that we see coming through our doors.
So you've developed this new program to deal with this.
Is
it in direct response to these children and their particular needs?
Absolutely. So what we provide them is an evidence-based practice. We, with the help of LA County, we were able to hybridize a group to specifically target and work with the behaviors of the unaccompanied minors that are coming in and their symptoms.
And what are their symptoms?
Everywhere from nightmares, wetting the bed, severe depression, agoraphobia.
And were some of them sexually abused?
Some of them were, unfortunately. Some of them, I've heard actually some horror stories of some kids that are the coyotes indenturing them into sexual slavery to be able to pay for their ticket across the border.
And their parents are not with them?
Their parents are not with them.
How do you handle that? I mean, that is a severe trauma.
If their behaviors and their symptoms aren't so severe that they can handle a group, we'll place them in a group. And the first part of that group is that they see that they are not alone because they're coming to this country. Many of them speak a dialect of Spanish, especially if they're from mountainous regions, that's very different. And they're right in there, even in the Latino communities, it shows. They stand out like a sore thumb that they are strangers within that own community. They're strangers in a strange land over and over and over again. So the first thing they see in these groups is that this happened to you. This happened to you, and they're not feeling so alone. So we immediately try to bring a sense of community there, and that does reduce some of the emotional barriers to be able to discuss and disclose.
What happens when they get to school and you say they're again strangers in a strange land? What is it like for them at school?
Well, usually this population stays pretty quiet. They're not ones to get a lot of attention to themselves. But again, in the Latino community, there's subgroups, and there's actually racial slurs towards groups from Central America, and even people from Central America have racial slurs towards those from the mountainous regions, for the more indigenous. So we hear all of these things as they're coming in. So when they come to Amanecer, it's almost like a breath of fresh air. What we're able to provide them, the services, like, it doesn't matter where you're from, we're here to be able to help you. We were able to get a wonderful grant through Kaiser, and we're able to get a lot of these kids backpacks and school supplies, school clothes, and clothes to be able to step in front of the judge for their asylum hearings and be proud of the way they looked.
How do they know to go to you?
The majority of our referrals come from the Esperanza Group and Immigrant Defenders. They're the ones who these cases have been assigned to them. And then we have outsourced case managers from our agency that actually work there. And then the case managers talk to the attorneys. And if there's mental health issues, the attorneys are worried, they send them to us. We also occasionally get referrals from LAUSD. So some of those kids successfully crossed over. I would say probably 50% of them do not have asylum hearings, meaning that they are still not in the web per se, but we still are able to provide them the services and run through our program.
But they're still going to school, whether or not they've received asylum or not.
Correct.
How do the schools handle them? Do the schools have counselors that can help them?
They definitely lack the resources, great intents, but they definitely lack the resources to identify these kids. But when they do, they are pretty good about following through with referrals. The thing, though, is, like I mentioned, these kids stay quiet. These aren't the acting out kids. They want to blend in. They don't want to be noticed. So that's hard.
Yeah. And so maybe their teacher isn't even aware that they were a kid who came here by themselves from Central America.
They have to develop rapport with these kids, exactly. It is probably going to be a while because they don't step in saying, hey, I'm from Guatemala and this happened to me on the first day of school.
Can you just illustrate how it works, how it works differently from a regular MAP program?
Sure. The topics would be about the train ride, about the issues of dealing with gangs back in the home. So these are things that are going to speak to them directly. But it's specifically speaking to their experience coming through. Now, I'm not saying all of them had the same experience, but many of them did or witnessed terrible things happening to other people. It's all based off of interpersonal ability to handle it. But I will say that these are some of the most strongest individuals I have ever met. And to see that they are able to bounce back after hearing just the horrors that they went through, it just inspires hope.
And they really felt that they didn't have another choice, that they would have been killed if they hadn't left.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Some of the United States' greatest export, and it's not a great one, is Mara Salvatrucha.
The gang.
The gang. And so kids that are gang members here in the United States. Some of them on their own will go down and they'll take over whole towns and community. Others are deported, and those Central American countries, they do not have the government resources to be able to regulate them or the training.
And what is the biggest problem that these kids face here?
Well, for one, many times they're placed with family members that they don't even know. So loneliness, desperation, homesick. That's just to start. And after that is acculturation, not only, as I mentioned, not only into the Latino culture, but into Los Angeles, the United States. What am I doing here? Who am I? And then those that are reacting to severe traumas, the nightmares, the replaying of the terrible image that they saw, the inability to concentrate, severe depression, suicidality, self-mutilation. These are things that we're seeing in these clients. And so we have to address those behaviors right away.
How many kids are not getting treated, do you think?
I couldn't tell you, because those are the ones that slip past the web.
So you've worked with kids for a long time, right?
A long time.
Long time.
Yeah.
What's different about these kids, and what surprised you most about working with them?
They are so appreciative. Now, I'm not saying that the other kids that we work with aren't appreciative, but just the level of thank yous and wanting to stay after, there is a difference. They feel very comfortable at our agency.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Alejandro Lucas, Director of Children's Programs at Amenacer. Coming up, it's movie time. Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here to talk about the animated movie Kubo and the Two Strings, a new Werner Herzog documentary, and the latest version of the classic Ben-Hur.
No one's asking us to remake this film that won 11 Academy Awards in 1959, but let's do it anyway.
We'll go to the movies next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, which means film on Press Play. And we're going to talk about this weekend's new releases with Dave White, film critic with linoleum-knife.com. Hi.
Howdy.
Don't forget the dash. And Alonzo Duralde, who's chief film critic for The Wrap. Hi.
Hello.
All right. Let's begin with the big one. It is a remake of the Oscar-winning 1959 smash success, The Sword and Sandals epic.
How long were you a slave?
5 years.
What is your name?
Ben-Hur. My family was one of the most respected in Jerusalem. Welcome home.
Please, I need you to tell me who one's enemies are.
Masala, I won't name names. Until we were betrayed. By my own brother.
Should have stayed away.
You should have killed me.
I will.
Okay, Dave, you saw this one.
I sure did.
And? Did you live to tell the tale?
Yeah. I mean,
sort of.
Why?
Is part of you dead inside?
Why? And I'm saying this rhetorically. I know why. MGM, like all studios with money on their minds, they've got properties and they want to get some more money out of those properties. Like, you know, we haven't remade this movie since 1959. Why don't we do it?
No one's going to remember the original.
No one
remembers the most Oscar-winning movie ever made.
No one's asking us to remake this film that won 11 Academy Awards in 1959. But let's do it anyway. And so along comes Mark Burnett and Roman Downey, who helped make Son of God last year, year before, something like that.
And they were doing Christian-themed movies.
Yes. Admittedly, in 1925, the great silent version, and in 1959, the title was Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ. They shortened it this time around. They're trying to hide the tale of the Christ part of it from you, I guess.
I bet if you're in a certain demographic, though, it's being marketed to you as that tale of the Christ.
Oh, it absolutely, absolutely, totally
you
must be.
You can see it in the preview.
Because in those earlier versions, Christ was either far off to the side, or when he, involved himself in the action, you saw the back of his head, his hands. Not this time. Jesus is played by Rodrigo Santoro. He's got lines. He says all the things that you expect Jesus to say, and he's integral to the action. The story, if you've never seen either of the other earlier superior Ben-Hurs, two men, Judah Ben-Hur, who is a prince who eventually becomes a slave, and his adopted brother, Messala, who becomes a Roman soldier, they obviously have a conflict. And as revenge for Messala and the Roman army arresting his entire family, making them slaves and prisoners, there's going to be a chariot race to settle the score. Now, in 1925 and 1959, those chariot races were feats of filmmaking. They were thrilling to watch. They're thrilling now to watch. I've recently rewatched both of them. But now, in 2016, we have computers that
And it's actually making it less exciting because you think it could amp up the...
Well, you know, when some of it's a real horse and some of it's a cartoon horse, and you can kind of tell the difference. When 10,000 extras in 1959, all of whom needed to be fed lunch, I'm assuming, becomes a stadium of, you know, wiggling
the same pixels. Block of 200 people over and over again.
Right. Yeah. So you can actually see it.
I mean, they do a fairly good job of it's not cruddy looking. It's state of the art stuff that you're watching here. It's just less impressive to watch it.
It didn't do very well last night.
And it did not?
No.
I didn't know about that. But the problem here is that it's an unnecessary film. Competently made, not very exciting, and the parts that should be the most exciting, they suffer in comparison
to go rent the original.
What came before, yeah.
The originals.
Yes.
Okay, let's switch to a smaller animated film. This is Kubo and the Two Strings.
What was Father like?
He was just like you. Strong, funny, and so handsome.
Ugh, Mother.
But you got your magic from me.
I can fly? My name is Kubo. This is my story.
Your enemies aren't far behind.
Your magic is the only thing that can protect us. You need to learn control.
Release! Yeah. No!
Do you ever say anything encouraging?
I encourage you not to die.
I encourage you not to die.
Alonzo, you saw this one?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Well, it's gorgeous. As far as the aesthetics of it, it is a beautifully stop-motion animated film. It's from Laika Studios, the people that gave us Coraline and Paranorman and, for me, less successfully, The Box Trolls. And, you know, there are things in this movie that I don't think I've ever seen before that are stunning. I wish the writing were as strong as the visuals because, you know, there's a lot of familiarity here. It's your sort of Joseph Campbell hero's journey married to kind of a, you know, quest to put together the magical armor thing. And, you know, whatever, that's fine. It's a movie mainly aimed at kids. And so, you know, you let that go. But there's character things that don't really quite land. It's like this kid is, you know, is living in a cave with his mother. Father's dead. The mother whisked him away from her own father, the evil Moon King, who stole one of the boy's eyes. And she's hiding him away from the world to keep her father from getting the other one. He's a storyteller, but he doesn't, you know, this movie talks a lot about the importance of storytelling, ironically, given that that's where it kind of bobbles. You know, and then eventually things happen. He has to go on this quest with a monkey and a beetle who are voiced by Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, you know, I think it's a movie that families would enjoy together, and I think maybe very little kids might find it a little off-putting. But for the most part, you know, it's a gorgeous piece of work. I'd be prepared, I'd say, as a parent, to have kind of conversations about why some of the characters do some of the things they do and what certain things are going to mean, because it's a film that operates with a lot of metaphors, because it's about things like, you know, honoring the dead and you know, family and that kind of thing. But then it makes these plot choices where you're like, well, wait, so what does that mean now, and how does that affect what, you know? So I don't know, I was a little off put by that.
I have not yet seen this film, but in defense of Laika, everything they've done has been really great so far. And then, I mean, I think they're strong, not just visually, but story-wise as well.
I would agree with that for the first two. I think the Box Trolls.
I know you and I have argued back and forth about Box Trolls a few times. But yeah, I think they are such a refreshing presence in the world of animation. And I cannot wait to see this. So,
all right, on to a based on a true story comedy called War Dogs, about two dudes who win a huge Pentagon contract.
We won't let you down, sirs.
Not to mention your bid was far too attractive for us to pass up.
What did you mean by that exactly?
He means you boys lowballed the entire industry.
By how much?
You guys came in $53 million lower than the nearest competition.
Okay.
Okay. That's Jonah Hill, Miles Teller as the two boys. What'd you think, Dave?
If this film had an actual face, I would punch it.
Wow.
It's based on a book. Initially, it was a Rolling Stone article, but then it became a book called Arms and the Dudes. And it is about three young men who become sort of bottom feeder arms dealers. Mm-hmm. In the words of the film, picking up the crumbs. During the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. And
after the sort of scandals with Halliburton, where the government had to start opening up these contracts to bidding.
Yeah. So this film is a highly fictionalized version of the story. Not only do they completely eliminate one of the characters, one of the real-life human beings that participated in this, but stuff happens in the film that never happened. And that's not even the problem with the movie. You could distill stuff down. You could, you know, composite characters all you want. You could add funny, dramatic stuff that never happened. And you would still not have the problem that plagues this film. And that is a lack of concern about anything.
So no moral compass.
None. Zero.
Wow.
Absolutely.
And it's not even about the lack of a moral compass. You know, this is a movie that's about the sort of insanity of war and the commerce of the military-industrial complex, but it doesn't seem to have anything to say about any of those things or any ideas or any...
Is it just reveling in it? And
well, they touch on it briefly at the beginning where they explain, well, you know, here's why war happens. Money. And that sentence is meant to, I guess, absolve these two jerks for what they do next, which is become low-level war profiteers, actively endangering the lives of U.S. troops, and by dealing in defective merchandise and screwing over people along the way who are part of their, you know, money-making food chain. So, what this has in common with its predecessors, the Hangover films.
Also from the director.
Also from the same director and co-writer, Todd Phillips, is that we have now a series, a body of work from this filmmaker about young, straight, white guys who go off into different parts of the world and create chaos and havoc and misery and suffer no consequences.
This sounds very familiar
whatsoever.
Ryan Lochte.
in fact, yes, it's Ryan Lochte on a grand scale involving arms dealers. This is a despicable, terrible film.
Okay, finally, Werner Herzog has a new documentary about the digital age. It's called Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World.
This is the birthplace of the internet.
Let's enter this very special place. That machine over there is the first piece of internet equipment. This is a military hardened machine. It has a unique odor. And it was from here that the first message was sent. A revolution began.
All right, Alonso, we do want to see Werner Herzog discover the internet.
I hoped that he would say Twitter.
That's pretty good.
The thing about this movie is that, you know, Herzog is a fascinating filmmaker, as both narratively and making documentaries. The internet is such a giant topic that you could make a Ken Burns, you know, 40-hour thing about it and still only kind of be scratching the surface. So you can, you know, the movie's kind of divided into these chapters, and each vignette has some interesting ideas. One of them is about, you know, how solar flares might knock out the internet and cause global chaos. One is about how, you know, cyberbullying and how horrible that can be. One is about people who have to actually go to a rehab to break their addiction to the internet and to playing these online video games. And so each individual chapter is interesting, but they don't add up to any grand notions about what Herzog does or doesn't think about the internet. So, you know, in a way, it's almost, this feels more like a pilot to a TV series where every week Werner Herzog logs on and learns some new thing about the internet. But as a movie, it just kind of feels like these sort of thrown together vignettes that don't add up to much of a whole.
Isn't part of the appeal, though, is seeing Werner Herzog react to all the stuff that he learns and just listening to his voice?
Yes.
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think yes. We everybody does a Werner Herzog impersonation at this point, I think. You know, but I think I had more fun watching him in Jack Reacher. But I mean, it's look. He always has interesting things to say, and he always has cool observations. But I think that he's bitten off more than he can chew here, and anyone can. I don't think anybody could make a 2-hour documentary about the internet and have it feel even remotely comprehensive. And rather than sort of be really macro and focus on one specific thing, it just sort of feels like, well, like he picked his favorite index cards off the bulletin board and filmed those, and that's the movie.
I want to send you to Candy Crush rehab.
Oh, stop.
I think it's time.
All right, you guys, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you. Thanks.
Alonso Duraldi, chief film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Dave White is film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The animated movie Sausage Party has been a box office hit, and even some critics have embraced it. But when an animation news site posted an interview with the film's directors recently, the comments section filled up with terrible reviews, not of the film, but of the experience working on it. The producer of Sausage Party, Vancouver, Canada-based Nitrogen Studios, has been accused of not paying overtime while doubling work quotas, using threats of industry blacklisting, and denying some animators on-screen credit. Nitrogen Studios disputes the allegations. Sony, which distributed the movie, has not been commenting. Daniel Lay is a former animator and labor activist who writes about the industry on his blog, VFX Soldier. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Madeline, how are you? Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, great to have you. Well, as I said, this all began with anonymous comments on news sites, but as someone who has worked in the business, did these claims surprise you?
No, they didn't. In fact, when I saw the numbers come in for Sausage Party, I was just randomly, I figured with the budget so low, somebody had to have worked for free on it. So I go on Twitter, I say, Sausage Party unpaid, and lo and behold, I find some people there who claim that they weren't paid. And then I was pointed to the Cartoon Brew article, which you mentioned the comments on there, and I started tweeting that out, and a number of people in the media started picking up on it and started writing stories about it.
When you say the numbers are really low, you're talking about the budget being $19 million for this movie.
Yeah, that's extremely low, you know, for an animated film. It takes a lot of people who are paid very well to do those kind of films.
What's the usual budget for an animated movie?
Oh, usual budget. I mean, at DreamWorks, you could run well into $150 million, you know, sometimes. Now, those have been lowered recently, but well above $100 million is usually what a feature animated film would need to be made. I think for something like Sausage Party, you would need above $50 million, I mean, given the quality of the animation.
Wow. And so less than half of that. It was $19 million. What is the usual pay scale for animators?
Pay scale is usually done hourly, so in the U.S. you could see well above, you know, $50 an hour. So when I was working in the industry, when you count overtime, I was making about $135,000 to $160,000 a year routinely, but I was working almost, you know, sometimes 6 days, 7 days a week, you know, 12-hour days sometimes. So you work very long hours, and I think in Canada the advantage that they have there is that the government there will kick in and pay the producers 50% of above 50% of the salaries of resident visual effects artists there.
Resident, so they'd have to be Canadians, or?
No, you can actually, as an American, that's why a lot of our visual effects industry is gone here in Los Angeles. Many of them have had to, unfortunately, and reluctantly move up there to keep their jobs, essentially. And so they become residents. The companies will ask them to become residents, so they'll file their taxes there. And as a producer here in Los Angeles, you'll get a check, essentially, for 55% of their salary for the film that you're making. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think they were able to cut the budget so low in for Sausage Party. Is, you know, you'd think about maybe $50 million. You know, a good percentage of a film is mostly labor. So, you know, you're getting maybe 55% of that. And a lot of these people are kids out of school, so they're very eager to work, and they'll probably work for a very low rate or, you know, and work free overtime. So you'll definitely get a situation there where you can get a really low budget.
Well, so then is it a tale of exploitation if that's the way it works? You get young people eager to get a foothold in the industry, and they're willing to work overtime or willing to work for free. Is that normally what happens?
I think that normally is what happens in the entertainment industry. You know, I used to work at DreamWorks, and, you know, one of the directors that I worked for, I didn't know him personally, but was Conrad Vernon, who was the director of Sausage Party. I worked on Monsters vs. Aliens at DreamWorks, and I'm pretty sure he probably had some demands that were, that, you know, deadlines needed to be met, but we had a union. I was part of the Animation Guild here in Los Angeles. So that prevented a lot of the, you know, unpaid overtime or extraneous hours in the industry. Unfortunately, in Canada, the artists there have not yet unionized, even though the IA, which is a union I was a part of, is available up there.
And I understand the animators in this case signed a petition a year ago about these problems, these workplace grievances, and I guess they were fixed, the problems?
Well, those petitions, you know, we tend to want to go on social media to make our complaints because we want to do things as anonymously as possible. And I speak from experience. You know, I did write the VFX Soldier blog for a good amount of the majority of the time anonymously. But I think the fear is blacklisting, and also the fear is not being able to get your next job, you know, if you end up complaining too much. And I've been through the situation that a lot of the artists on that article were complaining about as far as Sausage Party was concerned.
Well, talk about the blacklisting. That is a real threat?
Oh, that's real. I can tell you right now, one of the best companies to work for was DreamWorks Animation. And, you know, I remember calling them, you know, after I was at Digital Domain to see if they had any availability. And, you know, HR just flatly let me know that I've been blacklisted because I did not renew my contract during the middle of Shrek, right after Shrek Forever After was done. I was on a film there, and I left in the middle of the production. So therefore, I was blacklisted, unfortunately.
So that meant that no animator, no producer would hire you?
Yeah, no producer would hire me at DreamWorks. I'm pretty sure I'm still blacklisted at DreamWorks. I could probably check HR there. I've had a lot of bad situations where even where I wasn't even paid, one company here in Los Angeles, Hydraulics, didn't pay me for 3 months. And when I finally told them, hey, you guys got to pay me or I'm going to leave, it almost got physical. You know, it's almost like I have to fight to get paid for, you know, after 3 months. It's pretty insane. They eventually paid me, but it was only after I left the company.
Even though you were part of a union.
For that particular company, I was not a part of the union. So the union has a very small footprint, you know, as far as the companies it represents. So you have to be working at a unionized facility, which mostly is Disney, DreamWorks, and Nickelodeon right now in Los Angeles.
And all the other animation has been outsourced to Canada and other countries?
Mostly in Canada, and the reason why is many of the visual effects facilities are not animation studios per se, but they're essentially vendors who bid on a lot of the projects, the major studio projects out there. They've been asked by the studios to move their facilities as much as possible to Canada because they would like to get the free money from the government there, which sometimes I think the Sony hack revealed, Sony was getting about almost $27 million, and they only paid $700,000 in taxes in Canada.
Well, thank you so much for shedding some light on this. It's really interesting.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you bringing me on the show.
My pleasure. Daniel Lay, former animator who writes about the industry on his blog, VFX Soldier. Okay, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Hi there, Madeline. So we started the show today talking about the Clinton Foundation, the controversy that has surrounded it. We asked listeners what they think, and we got kind of a feeling of people basically coming down on both sides. Deirdre Triplett said she feels like Bill and Hillary Clinton know very well what's legally, ethically permissible. They'll adjust as needed. But Gustavo Reyes says it's more than just appearances of conflict of interest. It's real conflict of interests. Looks like our listeners are kind of divided on the importance of the Clinton Foundation.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Christian. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
And you have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.